Well, one of the most famous radio programs of all time is one that began actually as a part of a particular individual's newscast during World War II. That's kind of how it began. It eventually came to be its own radio program. It premiered as this person's own series then on ABC Radio Networks in May of 1976. It is a Monday through Saturday broadcast, still going today. It is a program that comprises factual stories on a variety of subjects. It tends to have a surprise or twist that's saved till the end of the broadcast. That individual is a man named Paul Harvey. And the program, of course, is called The Rest of the Story. Harvey always concludes by saying, "And now you know the rest of the story." Well, I mentioned that phrase last week because this idea of telling the rest of the story is also what we find going on in King Solomon's journal in the book of Ecclesiastes, some journaling that took place centuries before Paul Harvey. We find in this personal journal Solomon giving his readers the rest of the story about a particular topic that we introduced last week, and that's the topic of wealth. He has mentioned wealth before in this journal, Ecclesiastes, but in chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes, verses 8 to 20, is particularly discussing it from a vantage point that gives us the rest of the story about wealth. I mentioned to you that Solomon was richer than we could possibly imagine. One might think that if you have that much money, if you're that wealthy as Solomon was, that surely he would have the answer to every problem in life. But it's not that way. Wealth doesn't automatically mean that at all. And Solomon wants some others to know that. In fact, he really wants to warn of some of the dangers associated with wealth. So we looked at this section of his journal last week, and I invite you to turn to it again, Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And as we look at his comments on wealth, I want you to keep in mind something else that I pointed out, and that is that the point he's making in this section in verses 8 to 20 is not that all money is evil or that money itself is inherently evil. The point is rather that just that there are some drawbacks to wealth. There are some dangers. There are some drawbacks. There are some things a person must understand about wealth so that he has a realistic or an accurate viewpoint of it. Now, last week, we looked at the first three drawbacks to wealth that Solomon provided for us. In verses 8 to 9, I pointed out that, number one, wealth can dull the conscience. If we're not careful, it can dull the conscience so that we're no longer sensitive to the needs of other people, those who have less. And he gives an illustration, the primary one he had in his mind, the illustration of the rich who generally control government. And that's true, been true through history. Generally. I know there are exceptions to that, but generally it's true. And he's just pointing out that if their consciences become dulled because of the level of the wealth they have, and maybe even because they have the ability now, because of notoriety, to make even more money. They have the ability in some cases to work the system and to be unfair and unjust to make more money for their own pockets. Because that's true, if their consciences are dulled because of wealth, they can end up oppressing the poor. So he gives that as a warning. It is a drawback to wealth. It can dull the conscience. Verse 10 is the second drawback to wealth. I pointed out that number two, wealth can disappoint, especially the covetous. It can disappoint the covetous. In verse 10, we find this fact that money never satisfies. If we're looking for satisfaction in money, it never satisfies because it does just the opposite. It whets the appetite. Once you have some, it whets the appetite for more. It's addictive, if you want to say that, but it's definitely not satisfactory. A third drawback to wealth, verses 11 and 12, wealth can destroy peace of mind. It can dull, it can disappoint, it can destroy. It destroys peace of mind, potentially, 11 and 12. Solomon gives us the picture there of a man with increased money and increased possessions for whatever reason, who now has more anxieties than he's ever had. There's more people now surrounding him, more people living off his salary than he would ever dream possible. The idea is that wealth many times attracts human leeches who end up giving the individual, the rich person, no peace. Solomon points out that he can't even enjoy a restful night of sleep because his peace of mind has been devastated. The passage continues there now in verses 13 and following to give us one more drawback to wealth. So a fourth and final drawback. And again, I repeat it, the ultimate point is not that wealth is bad, only that extreme caution must be exercised so that we avoid these dangers. The fourth is this: wealth can disappear. It can disappear. Let me read verses 13 to 17. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. As he had come, naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. And this is also a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Let's go back and look at this and how it makes the point that wealth can disappear. So be aware of that. Verse 13, it's the idea that wealth has been acquired in some way. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded. So he's got riches, this individual. He's acquired it somehow. But there's something grievous, and the Hebrew word there means literally painful or sickening. It's actually from a Hebrew word that means to become ill, to become sick. So it's sickening. There's something painful about this. He has acquired wealth, but while he was acquiring it during his life, it did him absolutely no good personally because he was just hoarding it instead of doing something with it. So he sets the stage with this story. A person who has acquired wealth somehow, and he's just holding on to it, not doing anything with it. It's not benefiting him, even, unfortunately. Verse 14, the first part. At some point, for some reason, there's a sudden reversal of circumstances. Okay? Sudden reversal of circumstances. He loses it. Gives the idea through a bad investment of some sort. And the last part of verse 14, to make it worse or to add to the tragedy, now he has a son that's affected by this. A son's affected due to the subsequent inability to pass anything on to him because he's lost it. That's the storyline here. Verse 15. Solomon points out, well, you have an inability to take anything with you that you've accumulated. Once you come to the end of your life, it doesn't matter how much you made. It doesn't matter how much you've lost. Death becomes the great evener anyway. 15 is just talking about the inability to take anything with you. Literally, you can take nothing in your hand. You can't carry anything in your hand. It's referring to nothing material. I mean, you take your reputation with you, so to speak. But you can't take anything material with you. Verse 16. Here's the grim view of the life of the one who had wealth and loved it, but then lost it. But it's even more. It's the view of all of us here. What a man has in his hand at birth, get this thought, whatever capital, verse 16 is pointing out, whatever capital you had in your hand when you were born, that's the same amount of capital that you're going to leave with. And how much is it? Nothing. What you take with you in the end is going to correspond exactly with what you brought with you. So I just quickly went through those four verses just to kind of set the stage here for what Solomon is trying to say. A man has riches. He didn't use it for himself. He just made it grow. It got bigger and bigger, this wealth. It increased. But for some reason, there was a reversal of circumstances. Now he has nothing to pass on to anybody else. But when it's all said and done, it doesn't matter if he did. When he dies, he's going to take nothing with him. Because exactly as a man is born, whatever money he has then and whatever possession he has then, that's what he's going to have when he leaves. Now, my dad was a pastor, so I grew up acquainted with funerals. As a pastor myself, I have officiated at several funerals, whether they were babies all the way up to senior saints, funerals of both unbelievers and Christians. As a person, I have attended several funerals. And I'm sure you can say that as well. You have been to funerals. And as a pastor, I've even witnessed some peculiar things and memorable events that have happened at funerals. But one thing I can definitely say that all of us could say, but as a pastor I can definitely say, I've never conducted a funeral, nor even attended a funeral, where the casket is occupied by someone who has his hands full. Okay. I mean, people are usually buried in nice clothes, and a man's buried in a nice suit, but even there's no need for the pockets. There's no need for anything in his hand. Why? Because of that famous statement. You can't take it with you. You can't take it with you. Now, it's easy when you read the words of the story to envision this man who's hoarded all this wealth that he had, and then he loses it. I mean, you can understand that. He says a bad investment, but there's a lot of things that we could put there. Those who lose it through some sort of foolish gambling choice or some other misguided venture. Perhaps you can even envision the person who makes his way to the top. He wins his way to the top, but suddenly the stock market plunges and the bottom just is knocked out from underneath him. The bottom drops out of his life. Or the person who spends his life accumulating it in the maddening pursuit of some financial goal who suddenly drops dead of a heart attack. I mean, these things happen. Whatever the reason, riches can be suddenly and catastrophically lost. These things happen. Some things like this happen every day. So that's why Solomon says it was all toiling for the wind anyway. Because a person is going to end up departing exactly as he entered life. He's going to depart naked. He's going to depart without a dime to his name. Because wealth can disappear in a moment while you're alive, but when you breathe your last, it disappears anyway. I once heard a humorous illustration told of a hearse that was driving down the street, headed toward a cemetery, and there was a group of people on the sidewalk as it passed by, and someone said about the man who had died, you know, he was a wealthy man at one point in his life for many years, but when he died, he died penniless, with nothing. And a young lad in the group, upon hearing that, commented, "Wow, sounds like he timed it perfectly." Yeah. In other words, it made sense. If he had a lot, then die with nothing, worked out just right. It's not sad in that child's understanding. Look over at Job chapter 1. You may have already thought about this, but Job says something very similar here. Job chapter 1, verse 21. Job chapter 1, verse 21. This is after he lost everything. And at this point in the story, Job, in verse 20, falls down to the ground and worships. He said in verse 21, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job understood that in chapter 1, verse 21. That wealth is like that. It is something temporary. It's going to disappear for one reason or another. You lose it all. It can happen in a second. Or you lose it when you die. You do not take it with you. Since we're studying Solomon's journal, let's look at Proverbs. The book of Proverbs. Solomon wrote much of Proverbs. Look at Proverbs 23. Verses 1 to 4. Maybe even 1 to 5. In 1 and 2, He says in Proverbs 23, when you sit down to dine with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat if you are a man of great appetite. Now, he's not describing a fail-safe diet plan here. Okay, that's not it. A diet plan that will always work. He doesn't literally have a literal knife in his mind or a literal throat. It's a symbolic statement. He's basically saying, catch yourself before you fall into the trap of being so attracted to all this that you want everything you see. You don't know what all entanglements can happen with this stuff. You don't know the tentacles that never seem to start reaching around you when you start getting into wealth and having everything that you think you want. But then he goes on to give a warning, verse 3. Do not desire his delicacies, for it is deceptive food. Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. Interesting that our currency has an eagle on it, either on the front or the back. I think it's supposed to represent the power and majesty of our government. There's a little bit of a prophetic statement there on another subject. Money flies away. That's what Solomon's saying here. Money makes itself wings and it disappears. Again, it can happen in this life. You will lose it one way or the other. All of it someday. It disappears. No one has ever been able to purchase security with wealth. It's impossible to do that. Back in Ecclesiastes then, chapter 5. Verse 17 kind of wraps up that little section of the warning and gives the picture of just how brief life really is and what a person's going to be like if he's depending on his wealth to bring him security, if he's depending on his wealth to bring him satisfaction. It says, throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Just a brief description of those words. Darkness is just a way to emphasize his misery. It's a metaphorical concept once again. It depicts joylessness. It depicts isolation. His preoccupation with his wealth, trying to protect it, trying to make sure that he doesn't lose any of it, actually led him to live this gloomy life. That's what Solomon is saying. I mean, he's got it all, but he knows he can lose it in a second, and he's trying to protect that. He's preoccupied with it, and so he ends up just being joyless. Great vexation. That's a word that just indicates frustration. They're tearing at his mind and heart. Sickness emphasizes that he even experienced some physical strain due to this turmoil. And anger points to times that he's even enraged, maybe over thwarted schemes that he's tried to create to make more money or his ambitions being thwarted. So here he is. He's hoarding. He's got it. He's going to protect it. He's hoarding it and protecting it because he knows he can lose it. And regardless of how much he protects it, one decision, one event, one stock market plunge, whatever, or maybe in a heart attack, he dies. Either way, it's gone. Wealth disappears. So what's the answer then? What's the answer to all these warnings? All that wealth can potentially do, these cautions? The answer there is in verses 18 to 20. Here's what I have seen to be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. He's giving a description of what God is able to do for somebody. To prevent the sad scenario, the scenario of being so preoccupied with protecting wealth that you live in turmoil, you live in fear that it's going to fly away. Solomon's saying, it is going to fly away. It's the nature of it. So step back and have a totally different approach to the whole thing. In fact, step back and realize that it doesn't have to end up being a life of darkness and gloom because you fear losing wealth. There is another way to live. And what he points out in these three verses ultimately ends up being three gifts from God that are good and fitting, he says, verse 18. In other words, these gifts, these things that God provides for us, ends up being good news. News we need when we think about all the drawbacks to wealth. These are valuable things. In fact, what he points out now are things that money could never buy. Even Solomon didn't have enough money to get what verses 18 and 19 and 20 are talking about. Let me just quickly tell you what they are. Verse 18, it's the gift of enjoyment. God is able to provide enjoyment. There's another life, Solomon says, that he's seen. Here's what I have seen. I know it's possible. A life of joy. And he says it's ultimately a reward. It's a gift from God. End of verse 18. He says this. When you drink, when you eat. In other words, when you're just living out your life. That's just a way of saying when you're going about your life, you're eating and you're drinking. Go about your life in such a way it's possible, he says, to do it and enjoy it. Whether you have little or much. Don't let yourself get caught in this greed trap of thinking that it's the money that's going to do that. It won't do that. Don't make your top priority to just make more and more and more for what the reason is that some people do that, and that is just for the reason to make more. He's really saying, enjoy life. We've seen this before in Ecclesiastes. Here it is again. This is a major theme in this journal. Enjoy your life. Laugh more. Find pleasure in the simple things as you go about your life. You see, the ability to do that is a reward from God. The person who seeks God, the person who makes God, knowing Him, serving Him, loving Him the priority, whether you end up wealthy or not, has as a reward the ability to enjoy Himself. It's a good thing. Christians are supposed to be that way. Number two, verse 19. What's another answer to all this? The gift of fulfillment. Fulfillment. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, He has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. It's fulfillment, but it's fulfillment in the work, in the labor. Whatever the labor is, it's not that it's an end result. The end result of it is just to get paid, though we need that. There's something else God gives. God gives the ability to actually enjoy the working in it. Now, notice in verse 19 that riches are not necessarily bad. We get that point here because God gives it to some. God has given riches and wealth. So we know money's not the issue, but He has the ability to give something else. The ability to enjoy it and to be fulfilled in the work that's producing it. Now, lost man thinks that wealth and enjoyment go together invariably. If you have one, you'd have the other. But Solomon here, the preacher, realizes they're distinct. God has to give them both. God has to give the wealth, but He's the one that also gives the fulfillment in the pursuit of it. And this principle in verse 19 applies to more than just what we would define perhaps as riches. In other words, any job, any ability to work, any labor is a gift from God. Whatever you're doing is a gift from God. And the enjoyment and the fulfillment that can be found in that job, whatever it is also a gift. So the application of that would be, if you have a job, then thank God for it. And seek His help in finding the fulfillment that is available in that labor, whatever it is. And partly, the key to finding that fulfillment depends on a person's attitude. A man must be in control of his attitude about the wealth rather than the attitude to wealth controlling him. See? So in your life and in your work, find fulfillment in whatever you do. It's to receive His reward and the rejoicing in His labor. To get that, that's a gift from God. Only God gives that. So seek Him for that. And then in your life and in your work, find that fulfillment. See, the fact is, it's not always true at all that there's a better job around the corner that's going to do it for you. There might be a better job for you around the corner. I'm not saying there wouldn't be. And there's certainly nothing wrong with seeking to better your financial position or better yourself. That's not the issue either. But there is no guarantee that the better job will satisfy you any more than your present one. See, no guarantee about that. The greener grass idea ultimately is a myth. There is fulfillment in your work available to you now, before thinking about bettering your situation. And you do this by investing more in the vertical dimension of life and less in the horizontal. So the person who is seeking God, once again, finds the fulfillment in the labor regardless of what it is. And then they're freed, because they're thinking vertically and not horizontally, free to invest whatever they've made, you know, for the Lord's work, investing their time for His glory, free to give generously because there's such joy and fulfillment in that. So the point is, if you live with an eternal mindset, it turns your job into a spiritual endeavor, whatever it is. It allows you to find that enjoyment in your job, regardless of what it is. That's a gift. And there's another gift, verse 20. The gift of contentment in your heart. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. What does it mean to consider the years of your life? That's back to this idea of a person so wrapped up in the horizontal, so wrapped up in his possessions, he's scared he's going to lose them all, or he's scared he's not going to make enough. And what he controls his thinking is this horizontal life, and time is wasted, is passing by. It's quickly fleeing. He thinks about his life. He's preoccupied with this world, this life. But this individual Solomon is talking about, he says, I've seen it where it doesn't have to be that way. I've seen a person gifted by God to be occupied with something else. Instead of being occupied with issues here, to be occupied with something else. The gladness of his heart. And who keeps him occupied with that? God does. So a God-centered man will not find life to end up being a drudgery. Instead, he'll find just the opposite. He'll be so preoccupied with God and the joy that God gives that the vanity of the life will practically be forgotten. You see, a lot of this book could be discouraging. It could cause a person to become preoccupied with vanity, because he said it over and over. It's toiling for the wind. It's vanity. It's all for nothing. And it's true. But Solomon draws a line here and says, yeah, but that's not what you need to be preoccupied with. That's just the fact. If you're preoccupied with that, you'll be miserable. But if you're preoccupied vertically with God, then you find this gladness in your heart. That's another way of describing contentment. Just living life as a contented person. So think about that. Those three points. Verse 18. God is able to reward a person with joy in life. God is able to help a person. He gifts them with the ability to actually rejoice in their labor, regardless of what it is, and not get caught up with the idea that it ends up being futile. And He is able to reward somebody with contentment in their heart. These three all go together. See, it's a mix. It is an incredible and ideal mix that Solomon is painting here. So whatever your situation in life, whether you're single, whether you're married, whether you're young, whether you're older, whether you feel like you've been sidelined in life, whether you're living a life in obscurity, whether you're alone, whatever, this mix is possible. Enjoyment, fulfillment in your labor, and gladness of heart or contentment. It's all available from the Lord. It only comes to the person who is willing to stop their focus horizontally and to focus vertically. That's the rest of the story, see, about wealth. Those cautions and the remedy to all of it. And as I said last time, we should be grateful to God that Solomon has journaled these things, the warnings, the proverbial principles that are mixed up in this story, these incredible and beautiful conclusions, verses 18 to 20. You can't purchase these. These conclusions have no price tag. So perhaps Matthew 6:33 then is the most appropriate way to conclude the lesson. Matthew 6:33 we're very familiar with. A New Testament expression of the same thing Solomon is saying. Seek ye first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. See, it's an issue of kingdoms. And that's our message to the world, ultimately. For real riches, for real joy, for real fulfillment, for real contentment and gladness of heart, it's a kingdom issue. Our message to the world is this. For those things, you need to switch kingdoms. You switch kingdoms, and you find these things. Let's pray.